When I first heard about the gift economy from Jen, we were at a Women in Black meeting, and I thought, you got to be kidding. There's no way this will work. And then as I thought about it, it became clear to me that Palestinians survived because of such economy. We depend on each other, closures and curfews. We depend on each other for survival. If you take, for example, Gaza, which has 85% unemployment rate, and the people, and this is for years, this has been going on for years, and people are still surviving. There's got to be some other economy. It cannot be exchange. So today I'm going to start with the history and how we got here from when the Palestinian-Israeli conflict started. So the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is a struggle over land, and which began a little over 100 years ago. Until 1948, all of what is now known as Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza was originally known as Palestine. Jewish claims to Palestine are based on the biblical promise to Abraham and his descendants, on the fact that this was the historical site of the Jewish Kingdom of Israel 2,000 years ago. Palestinians, on the other hand, are the indigenous people, and they include descendants of Abraham and the Hebrews. Until early 20th century, Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire. Arab Jews in Palestine were anti-Zionists and were opposed to the establishment of a Jewish state. The three faiths coexisted peacefully until the advent of political Zionism, which was brought to Palestine by European Jews. The politics of Zionism were influenced by colonial ideology that Europeans have the right to claim and settle other parts of the world. Zionism gained adherence among Jews and support from the West because of anti-Jewish pogroms in Russia, and later on the Nazi genocide during World War II. One of the prized laws that helped Jewish settlers dispossess Palestinians is the Ottoman Land Code of 1858. The new law required the registration of land in the name of individuals, changing land ownership laws from centuries-old communal land ownership in favor of private ownership, that is, from the gift economy to a capitalist system. That's where our problem started. The Ottoman Land Code was not put into effect until decades later. Unaware of the change, Arab farmers went on cultivating and living on their land without understanding that it was theirs, with the understanding that it was theirs. Unscrupulous elites circumvented the law and registered large tracts of land in their name, ignoring the inalienable communal rights of tenure. Farmers became aware only when absentee owners sold their land to Jewish settlers. Less than 6% was actually sold in this fashion on the eve of the creation of the Israeli state. Peasants who had been cultivating the lands for many generations and assumed de facto ownership found themselves evicted from their homes. Palestinian women's charitable society sprung up in Acre and the Mediterranean coast as early as 1902 to meet some of the needs of displaced, uprooted people. This was the beginning of women's effort in the national struggle and their initiation into the political sphere. As World War I was underway, the British convinced Arabs to revolt against the Ottoman Empire. In return, they promised to support the establishment of an Arab state in Palestine. But Britain made other promises that conflicted with the agreement with the Arabs. In 1917, the British Foreign Minister, Lord Balfour, announced his government's support for the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. At the same time, Britain and France secretly made agreements among themselves to divide the Arab areas that were under Ottoman control. Naturally, Arabs were angered by Britain's failure to fulfill its promise, demonstrations broke out, and in 1929, 200 Palestinian women attending the first Arab Women's Congress in Jerusalem marched in the street to protest the British policies in Palestine. They issued a revolutionary declaration to women to leave their duties and support their men in this national cause. Hitler's rise to power in 1933 led to a surge in Jewish immigration and settlements in Palestine. Escalating hostilities over the fate of Palestine compelled Britain to relinquish its mandate and turn the problem over to the United Nations. In 1947, the UN Assembly voted to partition Palestine into two states, one Jewish and the other Arab. The UN gave 56% of Palestine to Jews who owned 6% of the land and constituted less than 30% of the population. The remaining 44% was assigned to the Arab majority under Jordanian rule. The indigenous population of Palestine was therefore dispossessed of more than half of its land by democratic UN vote. It is as if your neighbors get together and vote by majority to take over your car. Publicly, the Zionist leadership accepted the UN partition, but not really. Within a year, Israel conquered 78% of Palestine, well beyond the UN partition plan. 750,000 Palestinians were dispossessed from their ancestral homes. An entire way of life was obliterated. More than 450 of their towns and villages were destroyed or pillaged, and people who had lived a settled life for generations ended up either in tents in Lebanon, Syria, or Jordan, or as a bereft and traumatized diaspora in every corner of the earth. In his book, Arabs in Israel for Beginners, Ron David gives an account of one of the methods used to accomplish the cleansing of Palestinians. And he wrote, April 1948, Zionist terror squads, the Irgun, massacred 254 Palestinians in the village of Deir Yassin. 254 Arab women, children, and old men were butchered by the Zionists, while the young Arab men worked in the fields. Unborn children were killed inside the guts of their murdered mothers. Within a few days, as the Zionists had hoped, 500,000 Palestinians fled their country in terror to make room for Israel. The Irgun command sent a message to its men, as in Deir Yassin, so everywhere. Menachem Begin, the twice elected prime minister of Israel, led the massacre at Deir Yassin. It was one of many to follow. 1948 armistice between Israel and the Arab states did not stop clashes along the borders. General Moshe Dayan said that Israel must invent dangers and adopt the method of provocation and revenge. He explained that Israelis would encroach across borders until they got a response from the Arab countries. Israel's aim was to terrorize Arabs and create fear among the Israeli citizens while claiming self-defense. But of course, the goal was to expand. In his diaries, Prime Minister Moshe Sheret wrote that 1967 occupation of the West Bank Gaza was planned as early as 1955. And he also said that by 1956 that Jews in the United States were informed of this plan. Now, how did the 1967 came about? Responding to a Syrian request for assistance in 1967, Egyptian troops entered the Sinai Peninsula, bordering Israel. The Egyptians then proclaimed a blockade of the Israeli port of Eilat on the Gulf of Aqaba, arguing that access to Eilat was through Egyptian territorial waters. Israel seized the diplomatic crisis and attacked Syria and Egypt and destroyed their air force within hours. The UN Security Council adopted Resolution 242, which notes the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force and called on Israel to withdraw from land seized in the Six-Day War. Israel, backed by the U.S., continues to refuse to comply. Israel established a military administration to govern the Palestinian residents of the occupied West Bank and Gaza. Under this arrangement, Palestinians were denied many political rights and civil liberties, including freedom of expression, freedom of the press, and freedom of political association. Palestinian nationalism was criminalized as a threat to Israel's security. Displaying the national colors, not the flag, just the colors, was a punishable act. All aspects of Palestinian life were regulated and severely restricted. In December 87, the Palestinian population started a mass uprising against the Israeli occupation. This uprising, or Intifada, was a popular grassroots mobilization that drew on the organizations and institutions that had developed under occupation. The movement involved hundreds of thousands of people, many with no previous resistance experience, including women, children, and teenagers. The population participated in civil disobedience, massive demonstrations, general strikes, refusal to pay taxes, and boycotts of Israeli products. The residents of Beit Zahur, a Christian village near Bethlehem, refused to pay taxes to the Israeli government. The authorities responded by confiscating furniture, appliances, and demolishing homes. A Palestinian woman, appealing to an Israeli soldier, begged him to leave her fridge so she can store milk for her infant. The soldier entered into a bargaining scheme, and he kept lowering the price until he reached the $1 mark, at which time she told him to just take the fridge. In 1985, Mubarak Awad, a Palestinian psychologist, established the Palestinian Center for the Study of Nonviolence. Awad organized many nonviolent actions. He encouraged his people to confront Israeli soldiers without arms, encouraged them not to cooperate with the authorities, and encouraged them to find their power from within and to work collectively to help each other. His actions were so effective and so challenging that the Israeli authorities deported him from his own country. As punishment for the Intifada, the Israeli authorities shut down schools and made education illegal. 300,000 Palestinian children were affected, the equivalent of approximately 30 million American kids. Palestinian teachers established underground schools, and home classes were organized throughout the territories. Israeli law considered such peaceful resistance punishable by a 10-year prison term and the demolition of a violator's home. Nevertheless, teachers accepted the consequences. Although the Intifada did not bring an end to the occupation, it made it clear the status quo was untenable. It shifted the center of gravity of Palestinian political initiative from the PLO leadership in Tunis to the occupied territories. In response to activists' demands for a clear political program to guide the struggle for independence, the Palestine National Council, a government in exile, convened in Algeria in November 1988, recognized the State of Israel, proclaimed an independent state in West Bank and Gaza, and renounced terrorism. Accepting their dispossession of 78% of Palestine was a huge sacrifice and an enormous gesture for peace with Israel. The Israeli government rejected these gestures, claiming that nothing had changed and that the PLO was a terrorist organization with which it would never negotiate. But the reality, of course, is otherwise. International support for Palestinians grew out of the Intifada, and criticism for Israel intensified, which led the Rabin government to reverse course. Israel initiated secret negotiations in Oslo, Norway, directly with the PLO, and the Israeli PLO Declaration of Principles were signed in Washington in September 1993. Bringing in Yasser Arafat's regime was seen by Israel as the lesser of two evils, by which the more threatening grassroots Intifada, which had captured the world's imagination, could be brought to an end. Immediately after the declaration of principles, Rabin announced in public that Yasser Arafat would be able to crush the Intifada without having to answer to the Israeli Court of Appeals or to human rights organizations. The process was supposed to have been completed by May 1999, but Israel refused to relinquish control over the occupied territories, and under Oslo, Labor and Likud government built new colonies and expanded existing ones. Salman Abu Sitteh, a Palestinian researcher, found that as agreements are signed, the building of settlements or colonies spike. A network of bypass roads was constructed to enable Israeli settlers to travel from their colonies to Israel proper without passing through Palestinian areas. And Palestinians found themselves confined to smaller and smaller pockets, their towns and villages crisscrossed by roads they are forbidden to use. Their economy deteriorated as movement of goods and people were restricted. Bypass roads were the precursor to the apartheid wall Israel is now building. This was years before the first suicide bombing. Palestinians realized that Israel used Oslo, like other agreements, as a tool to buy time and strengthen its grip on the occupied territories. Having no recourse to justice, despair reached a boiling point when Ariel Sharon visited Al-Aqsa compound accompanied by 1,000 police to assert Jewish sovereignty over the Muslim holy site. Like a volcano where built-up pressure must eventually be released, years of oppression and humiliation erupted on September 28, 2000 with the Second Intifada. In the past 4 years, Israel has reoccupied Jenin, Ramallah, Nablus, and Tul Karem, Gaza, and Khan Yunus. And as Israel massacred innocents along the way, demolished homes, tore streets, imprisoned youth, President Bush told us Israel has the right to defend itself. A sentiment regularly reflected among Democrats as well as Republicans. Israel is now building a 450-mile wall, claiming security as it confiscates more Palestinian land and creates open-air prisons. Practically unanimously and frequently, the world demands that Israel abide by international law and the Geneva Convention. Universal outrage at Israel's destruction of Palestinian homes and lives is met with arrogant disregard by the only superpower in the world. During the latest reinvasion of Gaza, the U.S. cast the one dissenting veto in a Security Council resolution demanding that Israel stop its path of destruction in Gaza. In July of this year, the International Court of Justice heard arguments about Israel's wall. The U.S. judge cast the only vote against it in an otherwise unanimous decision, finding Israel's wall illegal. I am reminded here of Audre Lorde's words. I quote, "We are functioning under government which stands on the wrong side of every single battle for liberation taking place upon this globe." Today, I want to give voice to a Palestinian woman and an Israeli woman who have been at the forefront of the Gift of the Peace movement. In her own words, Fatima Khaldi recounts her experience. She says, "I am from 1948 Palestine, but was born in Gaza. I'm a social worker and activist. My work as a woman fighting against the occupation began in Gaza during the First Intifada. With the Union of Palestinian Women, I set up 4 kindergartens which looked after children in the morning and were the meeting place for women in the afternoon. Every afternoon, we studied the history of Palestine and planned demonstrations. Eventually, each kindergarten was shut down by the soldiers. I moved to Jerusalem, to the Jerusalem area, and worked in the refugee camp of Shafat. The Israeli army had flooded the refugee camp and the old city of Jerusalem with drugs, and my work was to rehabilitate drug addicts. During this time, the Israeli occupation forces killed 3 Palestinians in prison, and so 200 of us women slept in the graveyard for 7 days as a protest. I guess I should hurry up and finish this. While she recounts several incidents in which, you know, whatever she tries to do peacefully, then it gets closed. She worked in, as a union organizer to organize for women, women's wages and that sort of thing. And the factories closed down because of the occupation. People weren't able to travel and checkpoints. I want to talk a little bit about Mali Malikar. She's the head of Bat Shalom. She's an Israeli peace activist. And she gives us an idea of what Israelis also face when they stand up against the occupation. And she says that 60 women, a third Israeli, third Palestinian, third internationals, went to protest the wall. And they were at a distance, and the soldiers started aiming their guns at them. And Mali yelled at to them, saying that we are here, this is a peaceful protest. And I'll tell you what she says. Suddenly, there was an onslaught of tear gas and stun grenades falling all around us, completely out of proportion to the quiet, non-provocative nature of our action. The grenades fell right there at our feet, and we were choking, unable to breathe. Most dispersed and ran back. Soldiers charged us and fell upon women, grabbing some whom they arrested. Most of the women had run back, trying to recover from the tear gas, but I remained as I wanted to talk to the soldiers to prevent the arrest of the four women. Suddenly, out of nowhere, four horses charged with border police mounted on them. I started to run away, but one of them, ridden by a girl soldier, caught up with me, and she struck me on my head with a baton. I fell, and then a second horse charged towards me, and I felt more blows on my head and back. There was no provocation whatsoever at any point while this was happening. Then I talk about the international solidarity movement, which really is a tribute to humanity. People from all over the world coming to stand, offered their bodies as human shields to prevent Israeli authorities. In the absurdities of our time, where nothing is as it seems, where the conflict is between monumentally unequal parties, Israel is still presented in the U.S. as a vulnerable country fighting for its security, a country with the world's fourth strongest military in the world, a country that continues to occupy all of Palestine, parts of Syria and Lebanon. It demands that the occupied guarantee its security. The only nuclear power in the Middle East demands that Palestinians who do not have an army, a navy, helicopter gunships, F-16 or WMDs, not even armed police, somehow guarantee Israel's security as the Israeli government invades and reinvades cities, towns, and villages, as it launches missiles into the most densely populated areas in the world, as it hunts children in their homes, on the way to school, even in their classrooms. I would like to conclude by paying tribute to the incredible human spirit of the Palestinian people. Their history has been falsified to justify injustices. Their homes have been taken away more than once. Their villages have been destroyed, and their children have been killed. Though full of pain and suffering, they have not given up. It is incredibly inspiring to see a people so steadfast in the face of the terror imposed on it for the past 100 years, starting with the English colonizers and continuing under the Israeli colonizers. Their cry today is for all peoples, including Jews, not to abandon their humanity. With millions of other people around the world, the Palestinians stand at the forefront for the struggle for peace, for justice, for freedom, and for liberty. Thank you.